Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Dr. Ian Fairley, an independent consultant on radiation in the environment. Dr. Fairley lives in London and has degrees in chemistry and radiation biology. His area of expertise is the dosimetric impacts of nuclear reactor emissions. He has written extensively on epidemiological studies of child leukemias near nuclear facilities and the hazards of tritium. Recently, he was scientific secretary to the UK government's committee examining radiation risks of internal emitters. Dr. Fairley has acted as a consultant to the European Parliament, the World Health Organization, and International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Dr. Ian Fairley, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
It's very much my pleasure.
Last time we met, Ian, we were in Berlin together at the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War conference, and Fukushima had just occurred, and everyone was really quite beside themselves, worried about what would happen. And I remember you arrived in Berlin. Was it Berlin? No. Was it Berlin? No, it was in Canada. I'm sorry. It was in Canada at a conference of the Global Physicians for Survival in Ottawa. And you arrived in Ottawa with a dosimeter, or in other words, a Geiger counter, and you got into the taxi and stuck it out the window to measure the radiation counts that might be arriving from Japan in Ottawa, because you are very deeply concerned. Can you, Ian Fairley, talk to us about how you felt since Fukushima has occurred? It's now 3 months almost to the day that the accident occurred. How you felt at the beginning of the time, what has happened in the interim, where we are now, and as a radiation biologist, you know, we want to know what you're thinking.
Yes. My main worry here in the UK anyway is that the incident has reached a position of fatigue in the media anyway. Media fatigue, they don't want to report it very much more. However, the situation at Fukushima remains critical, and it's very serious, and it's going to continue for quite some time as well, and it was far more serious than Chernobyl. The latest information that I have, and that I have to say that this is sort of a patchwork information, and it's not regular, and one has to treat the official sources of information with a heavy dose of salt. They're not designed to reveal the exact situation. But the latest information that I have is that there's ongoing criticality at Reactor 1.
Oh, really? I didn't read that today.
Yes, basically what appears to be happening is that there are sudden criticality episodes which last about 4 or 5 hours, and then water is pumped into by the authorities into the reactor, the criticality goes away, it dies down, and then a few days later it jumps back up again and they pump more water in.
How can you diagnose the criticality occurring?
By the radiation dosimeters recording as much as 250 sieverts per hour as the dose rate. That's sieverts per hour.
Well, now, how many rads is that per hour? 250 sieverts is...
Well,
you multiply it by 100.
Well, you multiply by
100 rads in a sievert. So 250 sievets equals
25,000
rads. That's
rads per hour.
Ginormous. Where are they measuring that? Outside the reactor number one or inside?
This is inside the reactor vessel.
Oh my God.
Inside the pressure vessel, I should say.
Yeah.
Now these are huge dust rates.
Mm-hmm.
And they are due to fissioning, and mostly from neutrons, from what I can gather.
Right.
It's difficult to say. There's certainly a dust rate from decay products.
No.
It's from, because these are episodic, because they are frequent, they must be from criticality. And this is all reactor one. This means that they have not got the situation under control, and it remains on a knife edge.
But reactor one has totally melted down, hasn't it? And gone
well,
through...
Well, all three reactors, one, two, and three, have not only melted down in the sense of the fuel inside the reactor vessels have melted, but it's actually melted through and is now in a pool in the bottom of the pressure vessels in reactors 1, 2, and 3.
Whole heap of lava.
Exactly.
Molten
it's called
lava.
Corium,
yeah.
A mixture of melted fuel, control rods, water pipes, and a huge mass of molten metal at the bottom of the concrete pressure vessels. And it's on, really, it's just a matter of time before... that goes through and into the bottom of the actual station itself. And if it ever hits the ground, well, there's a lot of water sloshing around there, and molten fuel, if it ever gets into that water, will immediately flash the steam, and you will have huge steam explosions going on.
Huge steam explosion. My God. Releasing huge amounts of radiation.
Mm-hmm. So the situation is critical. I use the two senses of the word.
Yes.
Firstly, that it's extremely serious.
Yes.
And secondly, that there is criticality going on. In other words, neutron fissioning. Some of your listeners may think that this will result in a bomb. Well, not really. It's more like a flash of neutrons and heat given off, and it isn't rapid enough or violent enough to result in an explosion.
In a nuclear explosion, yeah.
Like a nuclear weapon. That doesn't occur. Instead, what happens is you get a huge amount of radiation happening. And these are probably in small areas of the melted fuel. In other words, there'll be a small configuration where fissioning will be in such a geometry as to allow criticality to occur, because it's very highly dependent upon the shape of the fissile material.
Can you, Dr. Ian Felley, explain to the audience what criticality is and the flux of neutrons? Can you explain that?
Yeah. What happens with fissile material is that if you have enough of it and in a special small enough volume,
that's uranium or plutonium-239.
Yeah, exactly. U-235 or plutonium-239.
Yeah, yeah.
In this case, really, we're talking, in reactor one, we're talking about uranium-235.
Right.
What happens is that the uranium fissions into two smaller products, and it releases neutrons when it does that, and those neutrons go on to bombard other uranium atoms,
yes.
And they in turn fission, and you will have what you
or split apart.
Flux.
Yeah.
Exactly. A sudden flux of neutrons throughout the core area, and that results in very high radiation levels. And it may only take it'll be over and done with in about a few minutes or seconds. But the ongoing radioactivity results in the activation of many of the surrounding materials, and they themselves give off radiation.
Well, now, to explain what activation of surrounding materials is, you mean the metal of the containment vessel,
yes,
which contains cobalt and iron and other things that were not radioactive.
Correct, yes, and now they suddenly become radioactive and they decay.
Yeah.
So you have all this going on as a result of the continuing fissioning inside the reactor one. It's a very serious situation, but it's not the reactor one. It's not the only dangerous situation. There's also dangerous situations in reactors 3 and 2 as well, and in also in the fuel ponds of reactors 1, 2, 3, and 4. They are all overheating, and the Tokyo Electric Power Company are having real difficulties in trying to keep everything cool.
My God.
Basically, there isn't enough water, and they're using seawater, but what happens is that water becomes very radioactive because it's being sprayed on live fuel, basically. And it's contaminating all of that area with the runoff. So the whole area is becoming more and more and more radioactive.
And the underground water is becoming radioactive?
Well, that's been has been for some while. The whole area is covered in concrete, so there will be some seeping through.
Right.
But it's mainly the stuff being dumped into sea that is of concern.
Yeah.
And there's very large amounts of that being dumped into sea.
Yeah.
Greenpeace ships, for example, which are anchored 12 miles offshore, are monitoring very high levels of radioactivity. And as I say, that's 12 miles offshore.
And they found cesium in two whales 50 miles away.
It's the radioactive contamination going into the air is actually more worrisome than that going into the sea. Yeah. And although they have a 20-kilometer exclusion zone, there are areas much further out, 30, 40, 50 kilometers away, which are downwind, in other words, the direction of the prevailing winds, where there's been very high levels of radioactivity found in the air that people are breathing. And the thing about radioactivity to sea is that you can stop eating fish, but you can't stop breathing.
Breathing. You can't stop breathing. Well, that's difficult, isn't it?
Well, I know I shouldn't smile, but yes, it's quite serious. In other words, it really is a catastrophe, much worse than Chernobyl.
Why do you say
there was a fire which lasted 10 days.
Right.
And it spewed its radioactive plumes throughout Europe. And that was serious enough. But here we are, more than 3 months later. Today is July the 16th, so we're...
June the 16th.
3 months and 5 days.
Yes.
Going on. And this is likely to continue, certainly for the foreseeable future, I'd say probably to the end of the year, before there's any cessation of radioactivity being churned out into the atmosphere and into the sea. The main thing right now is to try and stop the ongoing criticalities. Reactor 1, that is really serious because if they fail to control these, for example, if they run out of water or their pumps fail or whatever, then the criticality could continue conceivably and keep on going and going and going, and then we'd be into uncharted territory. God knows what would happen. And I'm not ruling out a nuclear bomb type scenario.
You mean a nuclear explosion?
Could be. Because we're really in a situation where we don't know.
What
the exact situation is as regards to the criticality, where we don't know, for example, to what extent how much of the fuel is involved in going critical, of the molten fuel which is going critical.
Mm-hmm.
And they're controlling it right now ad hoc wise by pumping in water. That creates its own problems, of course. What happens if that stops? Or what happens if something happens? Well, these things are all unanticipated, so we're really in uncharted
waters. And what happens if there's another major aftershock?
Well,
yeah, and building exactly. 4 is unstable, and it's got that huge fuel pool on top of it where may have been some critical...
I've been writing some articles for various journals here in Britain and in Europe, and one of the things that has come out of this is that, and it's not been discussed, is the sequence of explosions of the reactors. And there have been 4 explosions.
Yeah.
But reactor 1 was seen on a video. Reactor 3 was seen on a video. Mm-hmm. But the ones at 2 and 4 weren't. And I stress that 4, it wasn't in the reactor vessels. It was in the actual fuel pond that the explosion occurred. Now, what happened is that... the explosions at reactor building, unit 2 and unit 4, happened within seconds or minutes of each other.
Really?
And yes, and that hasn't come across. On March the 17th, what happened was that there was an explosion in reactor 2.
Mm.
At 6 o'clock in the morning, and they don't. There's been very little written about what happened at reactor 2, but there was an explosion, and within, and we don't really know how long, but within seconds or minutes, certainly much less than 15 minutes, there was another explosion in reactor in unit 4 in the spent fuel pond of unit 4, and a number of people are surmising that the two were connected. In other words, the pressure wave from the explosion at reactor 2 triggered off something in spent fuel pond 4. It could have been a criticality, another one. We don't know. Neither of the explosions at 2 and 4 were recorded on video.
What I don't understand, though, is that the reactor vessel at Unit 2 did not break apart. It does have a couple of holes in it. Why? Where was the explosion? Was it in the building surrounding the reactor vessel?
We don't know. It was probably in the reactor at 2, but we're not quite sure.
Oh.
I've read that it's in the pressure suppression unit of reactor 2.
Mm.
That would still cause extensive damage inside the pressure vessel.
Right.
Also, from what I've been reading, that has resulted in the fuel melting down.
Mm. How did you find out? I've been reading the literature today too, but I have not read today that there's ongoing criticality in Unit 1. Where did you read that, Dr. Ian?
I'll send it to you.
Yeah.
I've just actually read it this morning, I haven't had time to dig out where it came from. But there are charts showing the sequence of criticality events, which I'll be sending to you as soon as this phone call is finished. Yeah.
Okay. So
it comes from a secondary source, and I've not been able to tie down where the primary source comes from. But the data is official.
Why? Do you say now that this accident is worse than Chernobyl? Yes, Chernobyl burnt for 10 days, but I suppose it's because there have been 3 meltdowns in the 3 reactors and
meltdowns and melt-throughs.
I mean melt-through. the reactor vessel into the into the building.
Into the building.
Also, four cooling pools have had fires or explosions or whatever, right?
Well, unit four has had an explosion in its fuel pond. The other ones we're not quite sure of yet, in the sense that it's been very difficult to keep them cool and keep them covered. There's been allegations that there's been fires in some of the fuel ponds. But
I saw a video today, Ian, that was taken 2 days ago, which in the middle of the night, I don't know, 3:30 a.m. in the morning or something, where it showed a huge cloud of steam or smoke rising, I think, from building four, but I don't know which one it was. And I watched it very carefully, and a Japanese person sent it to me, and it looked really scary. And it was in the middle of the night. I've found nothing on Twitter or anywhere else reporting what that meant. Do you know about that?
No. If you could send me the link, I'd like to see it.
I'll send you the link. So what Dr. Ian Fairley, I mean, I'm interviewing now, who is an independent consultant on radiation, and he has degrees in chemistry and radiation biology, and he is one of the more better informed people I've ever spoken about radiation biology. What is your prognosis then, or maybe you don't have a prognosis for what is going to happen, or what could happen, or what this means to Japan?
It's very difficult to say. Very difficult. The key thing is that is for me anyway is to express our my sorrow anyway at this continuing unfolding catastrophe, which is very serious.
Mm.
I feel very very sorry for the people who live round about. And it's going to put a strong damper on any economic recovery in the rest of Japan.
Yeah.
And it may happen. It certainly happened to the Soviet Union after Chernobyl. The Soviet Union was never the same. And indeed, Gorbachev, who was in power at the time, stated in his memoirs that, in his view, Chernobyl was a very key factor in the disintegration of the Soviet Union in 1991. The radioactivity has resulted in both Belarus and Ukraine being continuing their underdevelopment. That could happen to Japan as well. In other words, it could find its standing in the world economy tumbling.
Yes.
Its currency falling, despite the fact that there's a lot of money flooding into Japan right now from expatriates. It's a very sad scenario. In my view, what's really quite interesting is the different reactions throughout the rest of the world to the ongoing drama at Fukushima. Different countries seem to be learning different things. Japan, for example, has been switching off its nuclear reactors one by one as they fall due for their periodic re-inspections. Announce a huge improvement in its attitude towards renewable energies.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen in Italy recently, as a result of a referendum, 93% of the people voting rejected nuclear power, which is amazing. And a number of other countries have announced pauses or re-examinations of what's going on. However, that has to be balanced with the fact that in other countries, for example, France, Britain, and the United States, it's full speed ahead.
Yes, and full speed ahead in Canada.
In Canada as well.
And export of uranium full speed ahead in Australia. It's hardly made a dent in Australia's export of uranium.
It's very difficult to generalize. Different countries seem to, the leaderships in different countries seem to be taking totally different decisions to the leaderships in other countries. It's very interesting indeed. One could, if I were doing a politics class at university, I would a good exam question for would be is to explain the differences in the decisions by various governments as a result of Fukushima. It would certainly test a student's ability to try and understand what's going on.
Well, I read today that the Nuclear Energy Institute and two other organizations in America have got together to work out how to use Fukushima to promote nuclear power in America. I mean, I just can't say anything, but that's a wicked move. And these people, what's it going to take? Well, now let's sort of look at the scenario. If there is another major earthquake or if there is partly a nuclear explosion or a steam or hydrogen explosion, the wind now is blowing south over Japan because the wind has changed. The rains are coming. And my scenario is, I think, that should that happen, much of Japan could become uninhabitable. What do you think of that, Dr. Fairley?
I think it's very difficult to say, Helen. It's true that Tokyo is less than 200 kilometers away from Fukushima, in a south-westerly direction. I'm not privy to the weather patterns as it varies throughout the year, as they vary throughout the year. I shouldn't comment.
Well, I can, because I've been following it. The wind during the accident was blowing from west to east, and hence it went across the Pacific Ocean and the radiation. There was some fallout in North America and the like. But now, as the weather changes and they're moving into the summer, the winds now change and blow south, and the rains are coming. It's a rainy season, and that's bad because, as you know, that'll create hot spots in various places around Japan as the radiation is brought down. And I read today that there's a tea farm, I think it's southwest of Tokyo, about 20 miles or more southwest.
Yes, I read that too, yes.
The tea's full of cesium and the man can't sell his tea. And I also...
Well, even more dangerous than that, he asked the local prefecture not to announce the fact that they were selling radioactive tea, please, which I found quite reprehensible. It meant that people would be drinking radioactive tea and wouldn't know it, but the tea producer would be all right, thank you very much. Well, to me, that's just the wrong way of doing things. And what's basically, the Japanese government really need to get a grip on this. At the very least in Europe, what happened after 1986 at Chernobyl was that the European Union quickly announced a series of what they call CFILs, C-F-I-L, which stands for Contaminated Food Intervention Level.
Mm-hmm.
And these were maximum concentrations of radionuclides in food, which would prohibit the sale, transport, resale, or whatever, trade in radioactive foods of any kind. It was quite arbitrary in many ways because these numbers were sort of a rule of thumb.
Mm-hmm.
But they had the merit that you could actually use them, and that although they were relatively strict, it meant that that you were safe if the levels were below these levels, and people knew what to do, And another good point was that they were more strict in the case of infant food and baby food, which is, again, sort of common sense. The interesting thing was that what these sea fowls, although they were extremely useful and welcomed by trade, the nuclear industry attacked them because they said that they were putting out the wrong message. And they did all the best to try and minimize the information about these sea fowls. And it wasn't until years later that we found them. And in other words, people who were ordinary citizens could actually use these numbers and find them. But it only occurred, as I say, about 5 years after the event.
Well, are they still testing the food in Europe? I didn't know that they were, Ian.
Well, no, this was after the Chernobyl.
No, but I mean the food in Europe, much of it is still radioactive. There's a lot of cesium in the soil. There are radioactive pigs running around, you know?
Well, no, you have to be more careful, more precise. There are some areas of Europe, particularly upland areas, in Norway, Sweden, North England, and southern Scotland, North Wales, where there were very high depositions of radioactivity, and those areas are continuing to show high areas of radioactivity.
Yeah.
25 years after the event.
Yeah.
But that. It would be unfair to say that that is extremely widespread. It isn't. It's only in certain areas that this is.
Turkey got a hell of a fallout too.
Yes. According to some reports, I've seen that the European measurements of contamination didn't extend to certainly Asian Turkey anyway. It did cover European. There's a small part of Turkey which is on the west of the Bosporus, and that did receive quite a bit of radioactivity. Which what is intriguing is that the military government in Turkey have not learned the lesson of Chernobyl, and they're now proposing to build more nuclear power.
Oh, I know, I saw that. Well, now,
which is unbelievable.
You're an expert in radiation and internal emitters. Would you like to talk to the audience about the sort of radioactive elements that are being emitted from Fukushima now? Xenon, argon, krypton, tritium, carbon-14, iodine, cesium, and they've found curium-244, which they say is more dangerous than plutonium and americium. Would you like to sort of paint us a picture, Dr. Fairley, about what that means to food, to what happens in the food chain, what happens when these elements get into the human body, where they go, and how they can cause cancer and the like?
Yes. When you mention the word radiation to most people, the image that jumps into most people's minds is that of X-rays, in other words, of radiation coming towards the body from an outside source. And that's exactly what does happen, of course, when if you break an arm and go to the hospital and get an X-ray. However, that kind of radiation is, first of all, is well characterized. In other words, we can actually measure how much radiation there is and how much it will damage you. We've got a good handle on that. The kind of radiation which is more worrisome and in which there is a very large amount of uncertainty is the kind of radiation which gets inside you by your breathing it in, or by your eating it, or by, in other words, eating contaminated food, or by drinking contaminated water, or indeed by skin absorption. When these radionuclides get inside you, they radiate you from within. In other words, it's not coming into you from outside. It's radiating you from inside you. Now, to a very limited extent, that already occurs in the sense of we have radioactive potassium inside our bodies, and that in fact irradiates us and people near us to a very small extent. But what we're talking about is a very large increase in this, as a result of intakes of contaminated food and breathing in contaminated air and drinking contaminated water. Now, the kind of radionuclides we're talking about are radioactive hydrogen and radioactive carbon. These tend to stay inside the body, or small amounts of them do stay inside the body for longer periods of time. And obviously, it's not a good idea to have to drink contaminated radioactive water, for example, or breathe in contaminated radioactive air. Because there's a lot of water vapor in the air that we breathe in all the time, and that water vapor can be contaminated with radioactive hydrogen. There's another kind of what I would call fission products. There was cesium and strontium, cesium-137 and strontium-90, which if you eat it in contaminated food, it will stay inside your body and can radiate you from inside. That's quite serious. Cesium is strong enough, so if it lands on the ground, it will actually irradiate you externally as well as internally. So it's particularly nasty stuff. And when reactors are breached, operating reactors, that is, are breached, they give off large amounts of noble gases, xenon-131, xenon-133, 135, a whole array of xenon isotopes. In addition to that, they'll give off krypton-85, argon-41, and iodine as well, iodine-131. These are all gases which are put out in a huge surge, so to speak. When an operating reactor is breached. And that's what happened at these reactors shortly after the earthquake struck on March 11th this year. These gases travel around in the local area and are breathed in by people, and they give high radiation doses to the local population. And it's quite clear that iodine was released at this time, and I'm pretty sure that what we're going to be seeing is, as it happened at Chernobyl, is an increase in childhood thyroid cancers amongst the local population. The extent of that in terms of geographical area is difficult to estimate, because we only have a rough idea of what the weather patterns were like. And the incidence rates, well, again, we'll have to wait and see what happens. I'm afraid it's going to be an unpleasant legacy.
Well, we know from the New York Academy of Sciences report on Chernobyl that came out last year that probably more than 1 million people have died of various illnesses as a result of Chernobyl, many of them from malignancies, not just thyroid cancer, but leukemia and malignancies in many, many organs, because these radioactive elements go to various organs in the body. And so if Chernobyl wasn't as bad as Fukushima, I suppose, and the accident hasn't finished and in fact is ongoing, I suppose, Ian Fairley, one could extrapolate from the Chernobyl data and say that maybe there will be more than 1 million people who could or would be affected by various abnormalities, but including a lot of malignancy. You, as a radiation biologist, would you comment on that?
The thing about Chernobyl is that there has been a wide range of estimates of the fatalities arising from the radioactive cloud throughout Western and Eastern Europe. My best guesstimate, that's a phrase I would use, would be somewhere in the region of 50,000 to maybe 100,000. That's my estimate. I don't go along with the estimate of millions. But anyway, if you're talking that kind of number, then it, in many ways, it doesn't really matter. 50,000 deaths, 100,000 deaths, that's bad enough in many ways. And enough to be, certainly in the terms of learning lessons from it. Whether it's 100,000 people or a million people, it doesn't matter. The lesson is we shouldn't be going down that road.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the most important thing.
Yeah.
I think that there have been a number of careful estimates made, both within the IAEA and, in my case, without the IAEA. Myself and others were commissioned by the Green Party in the European Parliament to write a report about Chernobyl.
Yes.
And a good estimate of the number of deaths which were resulting. And we did this, and our estimate was between 30 and 60,000 deaths. Since then, I would up that estimate a little bit as a result of the information that we've received, mainly because of the ongoing high levels of contamination, which information about that has come out just recently. So essentially what it boils down to is this, is that what lessons are we going to, do we learn from this kind of exercise? And with me, it's this, that if you embrace the technology which can result in such massive numbers of deaths, we shouldn't go there.
No.
And in the words of Albert Einstein, nuclear power is a very complicated way of boiling water. And I think he actually said something like it's a heck of a way to make nuclear power.
No, he said nuclear power is a hell of a way to boil water.
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, it makes you wonder. I mean, there are many ways of boiling water. Why do we have to choose this fearsomely complicated way? The point about it is that nuclear is a supremely unforgiving technology.
Yes.
If anything goes wrong, then we pay for it in spades. And so I think that any intelligent person's reaction would be, well, let's look at the other ways. Let's look at the alternatives.
Yes.
And one of the interesting facts about renewable energy is this, that if you measure the total amount of energy from fossil fuels throughout the world, which is being consumed, in terms of the energy rate in kilowatts, and measure that against the amount of energy which is received on the surface of the Earth every day from the sun, then the total amount of man's reduction of energy is about roughly 1 or 2% of the total amount of energy received by the Earth from the sun every day.
1 to 2%.
1 or 2%. Yeah,
that's amazing.
It is. It makes you realize that how puny man's efforts are.
Yeah.
And secondly, how bountiful is the amount of energy that we receive from the sun.
And we can harness it. The other thing, of course, we haven't talked about, Ian, is radioactive waste. I mean, we've been talking about a ghastly accident, and we also know that a reactor on the Missouri River in Arkansas may be flooded too because of the floods there. But radioactive waste, that lasts forever, and it's something that absolutely cannot be dealt with, and down the time track will just be hideous for future generations, right?
Well, what really gets me is back at the early start of the nuclear power program in the United States, say in the 1950s and early 60s, when they were considering nuclear power, they knew, the engineers and scientists knew back then that that spent nuclear fuel was a headache, was a major problem.
Yeah.
Because of the ongoing radioactivity and decay heat.
Radioactive waste, yes.
And inside the spent fuel, radioactive waste. In other words, you have these spent fuel rods, which are remain extremely radioactive and will do so for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And we really haven't got a handle on what to do with that.
Nor will we ever.
Well, it's not so much not will we ever, it's just that what we're basically doing now is that we're saying, well, we don't know what to do with that.
Yeah.
We're
going
to pass the problem on to our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
Right. That's right.
Which is, to me, this is morally reprehensible.
Yes.
It's just not the right thing to do. And scientists, those nuclear scientists who dreamed up this nuclear power, basically as a way of soft-pedaling the fact that it actually you were making nuclear weapons, because one of the byproducts of nuclear weapons is nuclear power. And so they invented this excuse called Atoms for Peace, whereby they said, well, forget about the fact that we're making these nuclear warheads. Look at these goody-goodies that we're getting with nuclear power.
Well, what do you think the psychological dynamic of these scientists behind nuclear power? What? Where are their reptilian midbrains?
I think a lot of it's got to do with the viewpoint that many scientists have of the ineluctable progress of scientific development.
Technology.
The bountiful goods that we get from technology. I think there's a lot of that, yes. I mean, one of the interesting things is that I give advice to environmental groups, and quite a few instances this has occurred whereby they say, well, all right, nuclear power, nuclear fission is bad. And they say, well, yes, and they say in glowing terms, but shouldn't we go for nuclear fusion?
Oh, yes.
And I say, I look at them and I say, yeah, you haven't learned the lesson, have you? And that is that nuclear is a blind alley. It's a cul-de-sac which we should try and get out of as soon as possible. And fusion is just another aspect of that. And when they look a bit crestfallen, and by the way, one of the things is that your readers, your listeners should be aware of is that nuclear fusion involves just as much radioactivity, in Bechdel terms certainly, as nuclear fission. But I won't go into that right now. The thing is, the best response to those people, those enthusiasts for nuclear fusion, is to say that we already have a gigantic nuclear fusion reactor, which is
safely located 93 million
miles away. Yes,
I've got it.
So we should use that and the energy from that rather than trying to replicate it here on Earth.
Well, you know, Einstein once again said, the significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them. And he also said, he who joyfully marches to music in rank and file has already earned my contempt. He has been given a large brain by mistake, since for him the spinal cord would fully suffice.
Well, can we just Can we finish off here now, Helen?
Because we can. Are you ready to go?
I'm just going to give you another quote, and it's by a philosopher called George Santayana.
Oh, yes.
He died in about 1950s or so. And Santayana said that those governments that don't learn from history are condemned to repeat it.
Yes.
And that has very strong vibes as from Chernobyl and Fukushima.
Certainly.
And sadly, a number of governments still haven't learned the lesson. And
well,
with that, I'm going to have to ring off. What my problem is, the domestic one, is I've got builders here who are busily putting in double glazing.
Oh, my God. Well, that's a good thing. That's a good thing.
Yes, I know. I have a large bay window, which I've been putting off and putting it off and putting it off. And finally, I took the plunge, and now I've got it double.
Well, and now you can put on your Mozart piano concerto.
Certainly will.
And
the one that I hope your listeners will listen to is K-467, Piano Concerto 21. It's the one where the second movement, the Adagio, is the theme for Elvira Madigan.
Elvira Madigan. I love that.
Yeah,
that's
lovely.
Gorgeous. Well, Ian, it's been a wonderful and fascinating discussion and so very timely.
Me too.
Maybe, you know, in 6 months we might have to do it again.
Anyway, can I wish all your listeners all the very best, and I hope that you're not having too bad a winter down there.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Okay, now.
Okay.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Dr. Ian Fairley, an independent consultant on radiation in the environment, particularly the impacts of nuclear reactor emissions. I'd like to give one more quote from Einstein to finish off this this discussion. He said, "The world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it." There you go. That's up to all of us. We've all got to do something about it. And it's, you can't say, why don't they do it? There's a thing called the aorta syndrome. And it's not about the aorta coming out of the heart, the main vessel. It's about aorta fix the bridges, aorta shut nuclear power down, aorta get rid of nuclear weapons. You know what? It's not aorta. I will. The only person you can change is yourself. You can't change anyone else. And if you decide you will close down all the reactors in America, you can. That's called leadership. Lips. That was a song by Errol J.M. and the Trade Secrets. So with that, thank you for listening. We'll be back with you next time.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.